Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Wednesday, February 11th. Today we hear from the Executive Director of the Hawaii Campaign Spending Commission about new revelations by Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke about campaign donations that she failed to report. Luke talked with HPR's Ashley Mizuo to try and clear up the confusion. Is she the influential lawmaker tied to a federal bribery probe? Things aren't adding up. We hear from a Pulitzer Prize award-winning journalist who's in Honolulu to talk about why trust and truth is so important in today's media. We meet a bird with a white rump and a lovely song in today's Manu Minute. And we tip our hats to this season of love. We hear how two circus performers have juggled their profession with their relationship. Tune to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. A regularly scheduled meeting of the Hawaii Campaign Spending Commission is currently underway on its agenda or campaign spending bills this session, but it will not be taking up the issues swirling around Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke because they have only just recently surfaced. At issue is whether or not Luke violated state campaign laws. In 2022, Luke's campaign returned two $5,000 donations, but the commission says Luke amended the campaign spending report just last week on February 7th that it had failed to report receiving those contributions in the first place. The Lieutenant Governor's office told HPR the omission was flagged by Honolulu Civil Beach, which prompted it to self-report the error. We talked to Kristen Izumi Natau, the Campaign Spending Commission Executive Director, as she headed into her meeting this morning to understand what the commission's next step will be.
What I can say is that we're aware that Sylvia Luke's campaign filed a series of amended reports with the commission that have new contributions and some new expenditures that were not previously reported almost 4 years ago when the report was due. And when a candidate files reports with the commission, by law, they are certifying that the information contained in the report for that reporting period is true and accurate. So when we look at these amended reports and find out that there are contributions and expenditures not previously reported, those would be violations. So at this point in time, we're going to evaluate, look at what exactly was amended, and pursue those a course of action.
And how soon do you think the commission could take this up? You folks are meeting today. It's not obviously publicly noticed, and so you can't take it up today.
We are a sunshine. We are subject to the sunshine law, so we do have a agenda and that was published a week ago, and this was not on the agenda, so we are prohibited from speaking about it. But as staff, whenever we see situations like this, or in any event, any amended report, we will always take a look and pursue whatever course of action is necessary. So for this, we're just going to be in a position of evaluating it and moving on from there and letting the committee know what's going to happen if we are able to reach that point.
Izumi Natau says while her staff does plan a deeper dive on Luke's campaign records and establish a clear timeline, she could not say when it may come up before the commission. And HPR's Ashley Mizuo spoke with Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke late yesterday. Luke has come forward with details of a January 2022 meeting where she received two checks that lobbyist Toby Solidum and his stepdaughter, Kristen Pai, each gave Luke's campaign $5,000. And it was at a meeting attended by lawmaker Ty Cullen. Luke returned the two contributions after Cullen was arrested in a bribery probe, and he was just recently released from jail. Was the get-together with the lobbyist and Ty Cullen the same incident written about in a court filing by federal investigators? Is Luke the influential lawmaker tied to an ongoing federal probe?
It might help to start from the beginning. Can you, walk me through what happened that night at the dinner on January 20th, 2022? Who organized it? Where did you go? Who was with you? And, what did you talk about?
Yeah. So first of all, I'm not even sure if the dinner was January 20th, 2022, only because we are just assuming based on the checks that we got. So let me just kind of walk back. So I did have a meeting with, I did have a get together with Ty Cullen, Toby Soladom, and his daughter. And at that get together, Toby Soladom and the daughter gave me contribution to my campaign of $5,000 each. When we took a look at the checks, the date that they were deposited, the deposit was on the 21st. So the get together could have been any time before that. So we're not clear whether it happened on the 20th.
So the dinner that happened sometime around the 20th, before the 20th.
Before the 21st, right.
Where did you guys go? What did you guys talk about? Who decided to go to this dinner?
Yeah, so I don't really remember those details only because this was 4 years ago and it doesn't really stick out. The only reason why I recall the dinner is because the looking at the checks kind of helped me recollect how I got the checks.
So you can't recall, you know, like what the, I guess, like interaction was like when they decided to give you that $5,000 each campaign contribution, both Toby Soladom and Kristen Pai, right?
Right. You know, during that time, I just launched the lieutenant governor's race. And because of that, you know, there were a lot of people who were supportive of my campaign. So that wasn't unusual that I would get together with people and they would support my campaign through campaign contribution.
And is it pretty, you know, like, common, I guess, to, you know, go to dinner with somebody and then that result in, you know, campaign contributions?
There would be, you know, there could be events or there could be fundraiser, but it's not unusual that we would have a get together where someone would support my campaign through campaign contribution.
Okay, so then you go on to refund Soladom and Pai on March 25th, 2022. You know, what made you think that, you know, you should return the money when you have received previous donations from Soladom in the past?
Right. So after Ty Cullen was charged around in February, we decided to return the checks from Toby and his daughter only because of their close relationship with Ty Cullen. We just felt uncomfortable about keeping those checks.
Have you returned previous donations from Soladom from past campaigns? Like, I think there's like some in 2020 and like 2018, I believe.
Yeah. No, we have not returned those funds only because Toby is not charged with a crime. And at this point in time, at that point in time, we thought because Toby was close to Ty Cullen, we decided to just return those two checks.
Do you think that, you know, your colleagues who received, you know, particularly those who received campaign contributions around the same time from Toby Soladom, you know, do you think that they should return theirs as well?
Well, I mean, that's a kind of individual decision. Toby is not charged with a crime, as far as I know. So it's a personal decision that we made as part of our campaign. I can't comment on what other people should do or should have done.
Okay, I kind of want to turn to the campaign finance disclosure side of things. So in the original campaign expenditure report that you filed in 2022, it does contain the return of the two contributions to Pai and Soladom. So when did you realize that the two $5,000 checks from them were not reported in the contribution reports? And then why did you, you know, amend the campaign spending filings in 2025 and then again on Saturday?
Yeah. So the campaign finance reporting is sometimes about 6 months. So you have checks that are coming in from, you know, perhaps January to June. And during this time, checks come in and there are invoices. And at the end of a 6 month cycle, the campaign team does a reporting. I'm not sure why the refunds were reported, but not the input. But I trust that the campaign team did its best and they did their best to try to capture everything. In this situation, we were alerted that the refunds were reported, but not the deposit. So we corrected that for the record.
And then I saw that there's a correction also in 2025 as well. Can you speak to that one as well? Are they related at all? Or
what is the refund in 2025?
I think it was not a refund necessarily, but I saw that the campaign spending reports were amended in 2025 as well as on Saturday. So I was wondering if they were connected at all.
No. So usually what happens is because we were going through and doing self-auditing, we found different errors. So that's why we found different errors. And while we are trying to make corrections, we decided to make correction in other areas.
So then you were notified about the two $5,000 contributions not being reported this past week.
Yeah, in the last few days.
Okay. I think what I'm trying to grasp is, you know, why do you think that, you know, the influential lawmaker who allegedly accepted the $35,000 in the paper bag from the federal court filing I know that last year when, you know, Civil Beat's article asked about whether these contributions could be yours, you said there's 0% chance. So I'm wondering, you know, what has changed from last year to now to make you think that?
Yeah. So for me, nothing has changed. I still, Sylvia Luke did not take $35,000 from a single person at a meeting with Ty Cullen in a paper bag, or even not in a paper bag. I did not take $35,000 from a single person at a meeting with Ty Cullen. What I'm trying to clarify is that we did have a meeting with Ty Cullen and another individual and his daughter. So all I'm saying is we want to at least clarify that portion. But because of the reference to $35,000 in the federal document, that the facts don't line up.
Right. I think that's what I'm trying to get at, is that, you know, U.S. Attorney Ken Sorensen has reaffirmed that, you know, as recently as November in his letter to Speaker Nakamura, that it was $35,000 in a paper bag, which is pretty specific. So I'm wondering, I mean, do you think that he's mistaken in that, or is this something else entirely?
Yeah, I think that's something that that should be left up to the federal investigators. And it is very specific, but, you know, for me, the truth is all we have. And Sylvia Luke did not take $35,000 from a single individual at a meeting with Ty Cullen. And we definitely did not take $35,000 from someone in a paper bag.
Are you concerned at all that, you know, by coming forward like this and saying that, you know, it was possibly you that they're referring to in this, that if it is not you, that your, you know, admission, I guess, is possibly hiding the person who actually did come out and do this?
Yeah. You know, what we want to do is, as an elected official and one of the leaders in the state, if I have different facts that come to light, I want to make sure that I'm completely transparent. It is definitely possible that it could be somebody else, but, you know, I shouldn't hide from letting people know what the facts are. And even if it could be somebody else, or, you know, even if the facts end up being made clear, that's why I think it's really important for all of us to step back and wait for the Attorney General's office to finish its investigation. We're hopeful that the Attorney General's office will bring some clarity to this this situation.
To kind of go back a little bit, when we're looking at how we get to the $35,000, the two $5,000 checks, we understand, was from Toby Solitum and Kristen Pike. How did we get to the rest of the funds from there?
I don't know.
Okay. Because I think I saw that you had talked about the $25,000 that you had reached.
Oh, yeah. I see. Got it. Okay. So clearly, you know, people are trying to cobble up different amounts and trying to total $35,000. That's concerning, because you can always pick, okay, here's $5,000, here's $10,000, cobble it together to make $35,000. I explained that the $10,000 were for two checks from Toby and his daughter from one event. The $25,000, $25,100 that we donated to the campaign spending funds were donations that we received from 2014 to 2019 from Milton Choi and his family members and his affiliates. We identified 16 individual contributions during that time, and we took that amount and decided to donate it to the campaign spending election fund. And this happened in a completely different time frame, because that $25,000 is from, the checks are from 2014 to 2019, as opposed to the two checks from Toby Soledom and his daughter were from the 2022.
So what I'm hearing, and just to clarify one more time, you're not necessarily saying that for sure it's you that they're referring to in this, because there was no $35,000 exchange. There was no money in the bag, correct?
Correct. Absolutely not. I am not saying the influential lawmaker is me. What I'm saying is that there was a meeting, and who knows, you know, I mean, depending on what the Attorney General's office is saying, there could be different facts that we don't know about that will become clear, but I'm not saying I am the influential lawmaker in question.
And then you're also not necessarily saying either that U.S. Attorney Ken Sorensen saying that it was $35,000 in the bag in January 2022. That's not a mistake.
Correct.
Necessarily.
Right. So that's not up to me to speculate or guess. That's why I think it's important for us to wait for the Attorney General's office to complete its investigation. And we're all hoping that they will find clarity in this.
And then, you know, there's a lot of different types of campaign spending reform bills making its way through the legislature, you know, right now. You know, are there any that stick out to you that you want to see implemented or passed this session that might speak to kind of the heart of some of the things that this allegation has brought up?
No, I completely support the legislature in refining the campaign spending laws. Anytime we do that, I think it ensures and builds public trust. So, I'm glad that they're having discussions.
Is there anything else that you wanted to add that you think that we missed or that you wanted to clarify?
No, you know, thanks for this time. Thanks for making it clear that, yeah, I just want to put it out there that I did not take $35,000 from a single person at a meeting with Ty Cullen.
That was Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke and HPR's Ashley Mizzouo. Look for updates on this story on our website, HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Olson Trust, envisioning a Hawaii where its people are supported by the land, and the land is taken care of by its people. OlsonTrust.com.
AI is adapting more and more human capabilities every year.
Not something I expected, and I don't think it's something really anyone in the field, if they're being honest, could say they expected things to go this fast.
But does that mean AI is thinking like us? Our series Brainwaves continues on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2, following the world.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii State Federal Credit Union, helping homeowners with mortgage loan options to fit their needs at hawaiistatefcu.com. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Lender.
You know, it's pure coincidence that a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist is visiting Honolulu as questions swirl around a mystery lawmaker and $35,000 in a paper bag. Jody Cantor is an investigative reporter at the New York Times. She's here to talk about trust, truth, and power. She's the co-author of She Said and an investigation credited with starting the Me Too movement. The Conversations Maddie Bender spoke with Cantor about her career and her advice to journalists looking into the $35,000. But first we asked, does she love her job?
I do. I love so much about it. I mean, I'll name one thing that's really special, which is the connecting with strangers in search of a shared truth, even in our debased, poisonous, you know, somewhat sickened culture, even at a time when democracy often seems like it's on the rocks. A newspaper reporter can cold call somebody they don't know and earn trust and say, tell me your story, tell me the truth. I believe other people will care. And then miraculously, the person on the other end like might actually trust that reporter and form a bond and a compact of trust over stories and impact and just concern for fellow human beings.
It's been nearly a decade since the start of the Me Too movement, which was kicked off in part by your and Megan Toohey's reporting about Harvey Weinstein. Do you think the legacy of that reporting has shaped how people are thinking about something like the release of the FBI's files into Jeffrey Epstein? What is different about our reaction as a society now because of what happened during the Me Too movement and what was uncovered in that reporting?
So the Me Too moment for me, and certainly the Weinstein story, was about truth. It was about the fact that these women's stories had been more than forgotten. I mean, they had been willfully hidden. Weinstein did this stuff, used very sophisticated tools to erase it. And so people didn't know. And so it was about the unearthing of those stories, really listening to the women, but also building factual consensus. The Weinstein story had enormous impact because people could trust what we published. We had receipts. We had all these different forms of evidence. We had a pattern that was indisputable. So the debate after that story broke was not, what did Harvey Weinstein do to women? It was, how could this have happened? It was a better, richer, more productive debate. We weren't fighting over the basics of what had happened. You know, it's a painful thing to say, but were that story published today, would we have the same impact? It's hard to say because the truth just feels so broken up and challenged and shattered. The two things I would say about the Epstein saga, without getting into too much detail, are that, first of all, I find it powerful that all these years later, and even with a very strong backlash to Me Too, people and people of diverse political backgrounds still feel empathy for these young women. The idea that this wealthy, powerful guy exploited them, it's just offensive to people across the country, across the board. And so it's been kind of a demonstration that the things that really underpin the Me Too moment, compassion for the women, the feeling that this was wrong, that power was misused, that's lasted. Like, that's durable because it's based on universal, timeless human feelings. Now, the thing that is really tricky about the Epstein story, however, is that we've never been able to achieve the same kind of factual consensus that we have with Weinstein. And this is not a criticism of anybody in particular. It's a way of being journalistically responsible and saying, here's what we know and here's what we don't know. Listen, my colleagues are doing rock solid coverage of the Epstein story in the New York Times, and they are really mining the release of those new documents for revelations. So I would really trust, you know, what's published in the paper, which is supported and vetted. But there is a lot about the Epstein story that is still very messy, right? He committed suicide. That obviously shuts off one of our most important sources of information. And now some of what's coming out in these files are allegations that have not been fully vetted, right? They're one person saying something has happened. In an investigative story in the New York Times, we try to add more support to that so that we can make sure that these very serious accusations are being leveled really fairly. So I would, you know, my advice in parsing the Epstein story is try to get your information from really reliable news sources and keep an eye on what we know for sure versus the huge body of like what just looks terrible and what we suspect. I mean, that's not good, but it's something different from having hard, verifiable info about what happened.
In 2023, you and the Times chief legal correspondent Adam Liptak teamed up into an investigation about the Dobbs decision, a TikTok, basically, and not the social media kind.
Not the social media no. kind. That's a really funny idea, Maddie. I will await the TikTok of the behind the scenes
right.
work of the court on the Dobbs decision.
I'm around too many young journalists that I feel like I had to specify. But your most recent scoop about the highest court in the land came, of course, last week. You reported that Supreme Court employees were asked to sign non-disclosure agreements after the 2024 election. From a journalist's perspective, what interests you about the secrecy surrounding the Supreme Court? And why do you want to peel back those layers to reveal how influential rulings like the Dobbs decision are being decided?
Well, thank you for asking. What I would say is journalists scrutinize power. That is job one. And we have 9 of the most powerful people in the country basically working in the dark. And, in an institution that is, on the one hand, at the center of our lives, right? And making a lot of big moves in the last few years. But on the other hand, very cut off and hard to see. Everybody who works there takes a vow of silence. There are no visitor logs or public records laws that apply. The truth is the law is not even common English. I mean, try to read a Supreme Court opinion. Some of them are pretty accessible. Others will just read like Latin to you. But what I want, and this is a group project in journalism. This isn't just me. It's with my colleagues at the Times. It's with other journalists across the spectrum. We want to illuminate this place. We want to understand it. There's going to be a lot of debate about the Supreme Court in coming years. Should we have more justices? Should there be age limits or term limits? Because we're the only constitutional democracy in the world that doesn't have age limits or term limits for judges. So when we have that debate, I want it to be based on good information on what this place really is, right? Our views of it are so polarized. It's so common to have people on the right lauding the current Supreme Court, people on the left deriding it. But with these really big questions about it, like how partisan are the judges actually? How political are they? How good are they at their jobs? How do they age in these roles? What does it mean for someone to hold power for 20 or 40 years at a time? We need actual, fair, accurate information about those big questions.
I want to get into the process of doing that kind of reporting, whether there's a comparison to be drawn from the type of reporting that you've been doing on the court, for instance, and the type of investigations that we as local journalists really want to get off the ground, but sometimes struggle with. I think something on our minds this morning and throughout this whole legislative session has been the discovery of in 2022 that an quote-unquote influential lawmaker accepted $35,000 allegedly in a paper bag. So how do you make inroads?
Ooh, well, without going into, a whole investigative reporting workshop on that, I would say like $35,000, it's hard for that to change hands without people knowing, right? Like banks are involved, money is moving around. Politicians have staffers. The people who might have given the bribe perhaps did not do so in complete secrecy. You want to use like the on the record tools of journalism to confront politicians, right? If there's I don't want to cast aspersions because I obviously don't know the facts here, but if you think there's a politician who's accepted a $35,000 bribe, one tool is to get in their face, right, as they're walking down the halls of the legislature, and whether with a notebook or a camera, just ask, did you accept this money? Have you ever accepted money from this entity? You know, ask it a couple of different ways to make sure they're not wiggling out of it, and capture and publish that answer, because if they're telling the truth, great, you're giving them a chance to represent themselves. And if they're lying, you want to get that answer out in public, because even broadcasting that could trigger more reporting, because maybe there's a scenario where somebody who knows differently gets in touch with you and says, hey, I heard that politician made that claim on TV that he never took that money, but I know otherwise, and I'm going to tip you off. So I would just, you know, encourage you to be relentless in asking those very good questions.
That was New York Times journalist Jody Cantor talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. Cantor will be appearing at a forum tomorrow night at Iolani School as part of the University of Hawaii's Better Tomorrow Speaker Series. Head to our website after the show for details on how to register.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA. For over 87 years, providing health plans to the people of Hawaii with a commitment to supporting the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
This Trump RX website rolled out last week, and there's been this drumbeat of press conference after press conference. And I think it's led to this expectation that it's going to be this huge deal and there are going to be all of these wonderful discounts on drugs. But if you look at the details of these actual deals, the reality is very different than that.
I'm Rachel Abrams. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
Support for HPR comes from Kona Choral Society's Gospel Heritage Concert, Sunday, February 15th, 4 p.m. at the Makaeo Pavilion at the Old Airport. No ticket required. KonaChoralSociety.org.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your Backyard Quiz. Do you remember Du Bois? Town and Country's gangly group of surfing hooligans graced advertisements, stickers, and t-shirts in the 1980s. Leading the group was the burly Thrilla Gorilla. Rounding out the gang were characters named Joe Cool and the Caveman, as well as an assorted cast of tiki men, suit-clad cats, and a green-skinned mutant. Some of Du Bois even appeared in the video game Town and Country Surf Designs, Wood and Water Rage, for the Nintendo Entertainment System. We've been told that the surf and skateboarding game was quite challenging, but a fact you may not know is that Du Bois were loosely based on major pro surfers of the era, including Dane Kealoha, Sean Thompson, and Ken Bradshaw. Always decked out in neon board shorts and carrying an array of boards from surfboards to skateboards under their arms, Du Bois define 80s cool. For today's quiz, we want to know, who is the artist who created Du Bois? Call 808-941-3689 or toll free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right wins a reusable HPR tote bag.
Surf.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for families of agricultural workers and retirees, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation. NereidHawaii.com. Waimea, sunset, pipeline, Haleiwa, Bell's land. Bamburas, Rafael's, Alamoan, and the Kaiser. Oh, everybody go surf.
And we now go to this week's Manu Minute in the Song of the White Rump Shama. Thanks to the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology for their recordings. Here's the University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart.
If you live on Kauai or Oahu, there's a good chance you've seen or heard the White Rump Shama. They measure about 10 inches from the tip of their bill to the end of their very long tail, and really stand out both in their plumage and in their song. The males have a beautiful glossy black back, chestnut-orange chest, white rump, and a particularly long black and white tail that flicks up and down when agitated. Females look similar, but their colors are less vibrant. The series of melodious trills and flute-like whistles that make up the male's song when he's trying to attract a female can often be heard year-round. The beauty of these songs is one of the reasons white rump shama are declining in much of their native habitat across Southeast Asia. With birdsong competitions becoming increasingly popular in many areas across that region, they're one of the most sought-after birds, with the best singers bringing big prize money to their often poor owners. White rump shama were introduced to Kauai in 1931, Oahu in 1940, and they've recently been reported and seem to be increasing on both Molokai and Maui. While many people still call them shama thrush, they're actually members of the Old World flycatcher family. They live on year-round territories in mostly non-native forest and lower elevation habitats, where they consume a mix of introduced fruits and insects. They do sometimes make it into our native forests, where they likely spread a variety of weeds and compete for resources with some of our much rarer native birds. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Ken and Patty Kupchak for the Friends of Oahu National Wildlife Refuges, James Campbell, Ko'olau Mountains, and Pearl Harbor. More at friendsofoahunwr.org.
Whole milk was banned from school lunches more than a decade ago, but it's coming back.
There is a belief that if whole milk was in school, kids would drink more of it because it would taste better.
I'm Kristen Schwab. What whole milk's return to the cafeteria could mean for schools and the dairy industry, next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6, following All Things Considered.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training.
As Valentine's Day approaches, we wanted to highlight some of the quirkier love stories in the islands. If you've seen Cirque du Soleil's Awana show at the Outrigger Waikiki Beachcomber Hotel, you may know that roller skaters Marina and Chris are married in real life. The dynamic pair met 15 years ago and performs as an acrobatic skating duo in the show. But we also learned that the two lovebirds are not the only couple in the cast of Hawaii's first resident Cirque show. Sophie Brundish and Christian Bazan flipped their way across the stage as voyagers on a catapulting canoe. Brundish and Bazan recently spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender. The acrobatic duo has been together since 2019. They met while working on a show in Macau. Brundish tells the meet-cute story.
Definitely wasn't love at first sight.
Nah, for sure not.
But then as we got to know each other, started to work together, we started to train some handstands together, yeah. Some acrobatic stuff, which was cool. It's something he never did before and he wanted to learn. Yeah. And then, as we got to talking.
Actually,
and
also English at that time was like very bad. Actually, I was very bad English, but I tried to communicate with her as much as I can using Google Translation or whatever. But I didn't fall in love the first time. Like, I was like, I was talking to my friend, I was like, it's okay. So, but as soon as we started training together and to know each other a little bit, step by step, day by day, and everything, it's how...
There was a synchronicity.
A lot of synchronicity. Like, yeah. Things that was there and we didn't know about it, and I think we get in love together.
Mm-hmm.
So the physical chemistry really came first. There was something about the ways that you could perform together that maybe got past the first impressions of what you thought about each other.
I think personality.
I think we are very similar personalities.
Yeah.
We kind of like shock each other of like, what is going on now? It's always like some big chemistry together at the same time. It was kind of like a bomb, you know, boom. And I was like looking at each other, I was like, this is real or not? They're like, I don't know, we just keep training together. I think the training keep us pushing inside more together. So it was a fun part of learning each other.
I think people hear circus arts, circus performer, and they think of the stereotype of a guy juggling or a magician taking a rabbit out of the hat. Mm-hmm. But your jobs are really physical, right?
Yeah, we both came from a artistic gymnastics background and then progressed into circus. But our circus is more acrobatic. So it's a lot of flipping, a lot of somersaults, a lot of jumping, not necessarily like the juggling or what you would think of as more traditional circus. Ours is still very much gymnastics. Yes. Right now we're on the voyaging swing, which is essentially a giant swing, and then we get catapulted off into a net, basically. Net.
It's kind of like
we've done lots of different
transforming gymnastics into like really similar in a different way, obviously, but that we're still keeping flipping the air, mm-hmm. flying, have that adrenaline that sometimes we kick us. And
our previous show was a water-based show, so it was a lot of more diving style into the water.
And how did you decide to apply to work at Awana together when Cirque was first opening this show a year ago? I mean, who came across the listing? Who said maybe
this one came with surprise, because to apply actually in the circus world, you know, it's sometimes it's difficult, like you and your couple, this way, you and my wife,
to get jobs together
and everything is
if you really have different skills, right?
It's really complicated. So actually, I received an email from Soleil.
But at this time, we were in separate countries.
I was in Spain with my family, and she was there in UK.
I was recovering from an injury at the time.
She was recovering for that time, and I received an email because I didn't talk to her on that day, and I was like reading this, and like it was an opportunity for coming to Hawaii to do a show, and actually I got her, and I say, cariño, I need to talk to you, you know, because,
like,
you know, it's a big step for us, you know, like we need to do this, we need to move again, or we need to like travel again. And
then I was like, actually, I need to talk to you too. Wait a minute.
So we both received that email on the same time. So actually it was
a very happy day for us.
It's kind of like when you win the lottery, it's kind of like feels like that, you know, like, we have a contract together on the same show, same country, and everything to work together. It's kind of like it's amazing for us. We can be more happy than that.
Yeah.
So it was really just a coincidence that Cirque emailed both of you. They didn't know that you were in a relationship or anything.
They'd heard about us. But I never think it's their main objective to, you know, they try obviously as much as possible, but it's really just about the artist that they need in front of them, right? Mm-hmm. For the specific show. And we had the specific skill set that they required, right? So
Because we've been working together actually in other shows in
this is our third show.
Companies. This is our third show that we've been working together.
It's a miracle.
This for us is kind of like a big lottery, and we are so grateful for us, and we are here now together.
We'll talk a bit more about the act that you're in Awana, the voyaging canoe. You have this swing and you have acrobats kind of jumping off and doing flips and tricks and landing into a net. But it's presented in this show in a unique way. So Sophie, set the stage.
So yeah, we're the voyagers. We're, you know, starting this journey and opening the stage for this crazy adventure to happen, you know, like we arrive at our destination and then bring in the audience along with our journey. And just, yeah, bring in the magic for them, you know, that we have such a show that's deeply rooted in the culture here. And we have all the hula dancers, and they're really like the heartbeat of the show. They are an incredible group of people, and the musicians and just everyone really. And
it's a really cultural show.
It's really beautiful.
It's not just another Vegas circus. It's different.
Yeah, it's a, you know, it's a different element. Like I feel like it's one that Cirque hasn't quite done before. So it's very unique. It's very intimate. And yeah, it's just really beautiful. Like, we're so lucky to be a part of it. And I'll be learning every day about more about the culture, and really lucky to be close to the people who hold this Aina so close to them and learn from them. And yeah, it's really beautiful.
What is each of your favorite moves or tricks that you do during the scene? Are you constantly, I mean, I've only seen the show once. Are you constantly switching them out, doing different things different nights?
We generally do pretty much the same, but occasionally we'll switch out different skills and stuff to keep it interesting. You know, there's always movement within the cast, so you have to accommodate different things.
But if it's the same thing always, but it's never the same, you know, it's never, the swing is actually is never the same, because it's a different timing, different ways to do it, different, so I like it, a thing, and we like it because it always keep you focused on that all the time, so every night it feels
different, feels new every night.
But any favorite moves that you might do as part of it?
I don't think I have a favorite. I think, I don't know. Yeah, I don't think I have a favorite. I love just flipping. Any flips. Anything upside down is fine.
Feel the adrenaline, no? We also, it's the first act of the show, so we kind of like... We put our energy to open the show in a very high level.
We have a responsibility
always to always be there, and it's the first act, and so we push always, try to... Full gas, we say, you know, we try to put
the energy up.
With high energy.
Yeah.
So, and we love it. Yeah, it's really nice.
Sophie, you mentioned just getting to learn more about the culture and the stories through Awana, and also through living in Hawaii. You both have been here almost a couple years. And so what do you feel like you've learned? What parts of the island culture have you related to?
I feel like it's something that I feel like everyone carries with them naturally, just like natural respect for like the land and the people and the culture, respecting each other, loving each other. But like, I feel like being around the hula dancers and really how they carry themselves, it's brought an extra awareness for me into like just how I associate with even like objects and like how I respect them differently. And yeah, it's just how I carry myself, I think. And I think one thing for me is the ocean.
Oh, the ocean. Yeah.
I was terrified of the ocean, like absolutely terrified. But then I came here and I saw everybody surfing, and I don't know, just feeling the connection again, like I said, to the earth a little more. And I just felt like drawn in, I think, which is crazy because I never thought that I would be in the ocean ever. And now, like, I love it. I love surfing, and just even when I enter the water, you know, I have a lot of respect for the ocean, and I'm like, thank you for having me, you know, thank you for taking care of me today, and look forward to the next session, you know, just the way that you step into the ocean, you step onto the land. Yeah, it's just something deeper now, which I'll carry with me, I think, forever.
Is there any advice that you would give to other couples, maybe people who live together and work together, or just run-of-the-mill couples, about what has worked for you?
A lot of patience.
Trust.
Yeah, a lot of patience, trust, and just a lot of talk to each other. I'm not a very talk person, but she opens me to kind of like talk. And we are very trust on each other. And we are being ourselves. We don't, because how we are in the show, we are outside as well, you know, like, so have fun. You have these things that when we are like grumpy of each other, we do
just pretend to be monkeys.
So when one is like one is really grumpy, having a bad day, and try to talk into you, and you're like, ooh, 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 ooh.
it just breaks the mysteriousness when it's not really anything important. You know, it's just silly bickering. You know, and actually it works for us. I mean, it might not work for everybody, but
it's really funny. We have all
these little things that we do. Yeah. But I think also like trusting, you know, that like I chose you and you chose me, and knowing that you're gonna be with each other through everything, and trusting even when it's hard that you have that person and they always have your back, even when it's hard and you feel like you just want to walk out the door. But you know, like just knowing that I choose him and he chooses me, I think makes you strong, because you know that's a certain, right? You choose each other.
We've been hearing from Cirque du Soleil Awana cast members Sophie Brundish and Christian Bazon. They were talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. In a note, Outrigger Hospitality Group is an HPR underwriter. Do you have a local love story to highlight this Valentine's Day? Drop us a line at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And now it's time to reveal the answer to today's quiz. Earlier in the show, we asked you to name the artist who dreamed up Du Bois for local surf apparel store Town & Country Surf Shop. Remember Thrilla Gorilla, Joe Cool, and the Caveman? Well, the artist who created this colorful cast of characters was born in Pennsylvania but moved to Riverside, California at the age of 4. He grew up with a passion for art and attended the Hollywood Art Center School to hone his craft. For TNC's crew of Du Bois, he drew on inspiration from the illustrations in Mad Magazine, as well as from DC and Marvel Comics, and even cartoons from Playboy. And while his art for TNC were his best known works, this artist also created designs for The Gecko, Information, PacSun, and more. Our mystery artist passed away last year, but his legacy lives on through all of the characters that he helped bring to life. So next time you see Thrilla Gorilla, we hope you think of creator Steve Nazar. And we had no winners today, but that was our answer. But that's our quiz. And if you have an idea to share, write to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We do have to go now. We're out of time. But up tomorrow, we survey the architectural landscape, why current building codes may be holding us back and adding construction costs to our changing skyline. Got a story you'd like to share? Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Check us out on social media or email talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find our archive shows online by searching for The Conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.